the universe has this order of movement, and we're all so connected. And it's really learning how to live in these rhythms that really amounts to health. We've gone so far into the dark tunnel of our intellect that honestly, intuition is rarely accessible to us unless we create a framework around it. When you understand the rules of the universe, you basically also understand how and when you can bend them. How much can you play? When can you play?
Welcome to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast, where we meet the world's top experts to explore the secrets of health, mindset, longevity, and so much more. Are you ready to take charge of your existence and biohack your life? This show is for you. Please keep in mind, we're not dispensing medical advice and are not responsible for any outcomes you may experience from implementing the tactics lying herein. So friends, are you ready to join me? Let's do this. Welcome back to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. Friends, I so enjoyed today's conversation with Nadee Pandya for her incredible book, Your Body Already Knows. I had been dying to dive deep into the world of Ayurveda, and Nadee's book was the perfect introduction to it. A lot of this was really a paradigm shift for me, especially when it comes to the ideal inner climate. As you guys know, I love my cold. So what does that mean when the ideal inner climate in Ayurveda is warm and moist? We talk about that in this episode. We also talk about the three different doshas. I was so impressed when only after talking to her for a few minutes, Nadee nailed me. We dive deep into so many other topics in today's episode, things like the role of dairy and ghee in health, oils and spices, the problems with raw food, and why and how you should cook your food, the implications of what a refrigerator does to your food, the growth transformation decay cycle, an Ayurvedic practice that Nadee says is basically one of the most fantastical, life-changing things you can do, and so much more. The show notes for today's episode will be at melanieavalon.com/Ayurveda. That's A-Y-U-R-V-E-D-A. Those show notes will have a full transcript as well as links to everything that we talked about, so definitely check that out. Hi friends, did you know that one of our largest sources of toxic exposure each and every day is through our skincare and makeup? It is so frightening the effects these compounds can have on our health. So we put these products on to help us look better, and yet they actually can be aging us, contributing to health issues, fertility issues, thyroid issues, mood issues, and ready for something potentially even more shocking? A lot of these endocrine disruptors are actually obesogens, meaning they cause your body to gain weight and make it harder to lose weight. That's right, your skincare and makeup may be hindering your weight loss goals. Europe has banned thousands of these compounds, and the US has banned around a dozen. There's even a loophole from the 1960s that allows companies to put whatever they want in their products, and they don't even have to tell you. That's why I am overwhelmingly careful about the skincare and makeup that I use. But here's the thing, it can be hard to find skincare and makeup that is non-toxic and actually works. And then on top of that, that actually has all the products you need. I have found two companies, I am obsessed with their standards and use them every single day of my life and cannot recommend them enough. That's Counter, formerly known as Beauty Counter, and Crunchy. Both of these companies have incredible standards when it comes to what they put in their products. You can truly feel good about using them, and they actually work. For Counter products, go to melanieavalon.com/counter. And for Crunchy products, go to crunchy.com. That's crunchy.com/Melanie Avalon. New Crunchy customers can use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 to get 10% off. You'll also receive something special from me after your first order. I also highly recommend joining both of their loyalty programs. It's completely free to join, and with every purchase, you'll earn credit as well as other fun goodies. For all the latest updates, new products, specials, deals, and fun things for me, because yes, I love giving things away, get on my email list. That's at melanieavalon.com/cleanbeauty. You can also get text updates when you text skincare to 877-861-8318. That's skincare to 877-861-8318. So again, to shop with me and get a free gift from me after your first order, go to melanieavalon.com/counter and also crunchy.com/Melanie Avalon. And new customers, use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 at Crunchy to get 10% off site-wide. And again, definitely join their free loyalty programs to earn credit on every order. Hey friends, exciting news. My Avalon X Spirulina is back in stock and now at a reduced price. Plus you get free shipping and my coupon code works on top of that sale price. Spirulina is honestly one of the most nutrient dense things that you can put in your body in a whole foods, easy to eat form. It's a blue-green algae, which is a complete vegan protein packed with an incredible array of nutrients. We are talking 100% of your daily hard-to-get vitamin K, 625% of vitamin B12, over 1,000% of vitamin A, 86% of chromium, 27% of vitamin B2, plus so much more, including iron, GLA, the powerful antioxidant superoxide dismutase, and even glutathione. In fact, spirulina is so uniquely nutritious that it was actually studied by NASA to support the astronauts. I searched high and low to find the very best spirulina out there. Ours comes from a wonderful, sustainable, clean, environmentally friendly production facility in Hawaii. Not Thailand, Hawaii. And then on top of that, we did our own third-party testing for over 70 pesticides, heavy metals, toxins, all the things. This is the cleanest spirulina out there. And with spirulina, you can simplify your supplement routine and support your nutrition in one easy step. The tablets are super versatile. You can swallow them whole, blend them into smoothies, crush them up, or honestly, just eat them like I do. And again, we were out of stock, but now Avalon X Spirulina is finally back in stock at a reduced price, and my coupon code MelanieAvalon works on top of that too. Plus, you get free shipping. Just go to avalonx.us/spirulina and use the coupon code MelanieAvalon to get 10% off our new reduced price plus free shipping. That's avalonx.us/spirulina with the coupon code MelanieAvalon. I can't wait to hear what you guys think. Definitely let me know in my Facebook group, IF Biohackers, Intermittent Fasting plus Real Foods plus Life. Comment something you learned or something that resonated with you on the pinned post to enter to win something that I love. And then check out my Instagram, find the Friday announcement post, and again, comment there to enter to win something that I love. All right, I think that's all the things. Without further ado, please enjoy this fabulous conversation with Nadee Pandya. Hi friends, welcome back to the show. I am so incredibly excited about the conversation I am about to have. So the backstory on this conversation, I get pitches for this show all the time with different books and authors and topics and all the things. And sometimes I receive information about a book and I just intuitively am an immediate yes, which is perfect given the title of the book. But so basically, I got this information about this book called Your Body Already Knows, Intuitive Ayurveda, 21 Days to Reset Your Gut, Sleep, Mood, and Health. And I was so excited because I've been very interested in Ayurveda, but I had not done a deep dive into it at all. Like the most I had done probably was take those online quizzes where you try to figure out your dosha. Like that's kind of where my knowledge ended. So the idea of reading an entire book about it and learning this perspective and paradigm was so exciting to me. And then when I actually read the book, oh my goodness, it just blew my mind. It was the perfect approach to this world because, well, I'm here with the author, Nadee Pandya, and what she does in the book is she provides a very wonderful, approachable understanding of the Ayurvedic approach to health and everything. So basically, she even says in the beginning, like, this isn't going to be, you know, this dictionary, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but this long list of these Ayurvedic words that you're not going to know. Like, she really focuses on key principles and makes it very approachable and relatable. And so you do learn about the doshas and the different body states and this paradigm shift of looking at your inner climate. You learn about key principles, things like the role of circadian rhythm and the growth and development and decay cycle in life. And then what's super fun is, I would say ends, but it's a huge part of the book. So it has the 21-day guide. And each day, and I really like how this introduces you to these different principles, but each day is a different principle that you can integrate into your life and just adopt this paradigm and see how it affects you. So thank you so much for all of your work and for all that you do and for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Melanie. I feel like you could speak on this podcast alone because you did such a good job of introducing the book and my work.
Oh, thank you so much. That makes my day. Yeah, I really, really enjoyed this book. It's really exciting when there's a topic that I have been had on the list to learn about, and then I get to. And it, this, like I said, this was the perfect way to do it. So, but to introduce you to listeners a little bit. So Nidhi, she's really a figure in this Ayurvedic sphere. She's a NAMA certified Ayurvedic doctor, but known for her modern approach. She's been all over the news. She is the creator of the Inner Climate Method. Like I said, she has this incredible book. So Nidhi, can you tell me a little bit about your background and your story? And you talk about in the book, you know, your childhood, how you were raised in these Ayurvedic principles, and your grandfather, you know, was a figure in the sphere. What was that like growing up? Did you ever deviate from this paradigm? Because I know you make comments throughout how you kind of see everything through this principle. Yeah. So what was that like growing up? How has it evolved and changed and led to where you are today?
Love it. Love it. So Melanie, I grew up in a large family. It was a joint family of 14 members in my family. So 7 children, 7 adults, which was 3 brothers living under one roof. And the patriarch of my family was my grandfather, who was also an Ayurvedic healer. And just the structure of the family is such that traditions are passed on. And for me, it was an Ayurvedic tradition that was passed on. So I say that Ayurveda was my first language. Like, I didn't grow up with health principles as dogmas, but I actually grew up with health inbuilt into how we lived, which basically means, let me give you an example, right? It wasn't the conversation. And back then, nobody talked about health that, you know, so much as we do today. But yet our conversations were more like, you know, it's sunny outside, it's such a great time to eat ice cream. Or, you know, are you sure you want to eat cheese at night? Isn't it hard to digest? Would it be harder to you know, it's easier to digest in the day. Now, as a little girl, when I'm hearing all of these dialogues, these comments being thrown around me, what I'm hearing is actually how nature works. So I get a message that, hey, cheese must be heavy to digest. And maybe nighttime is not the best time to digest food. At the same time, lunchtime is cheese is offered generously. So maybe lunch is a good time for me to eat the foods that I love and that are heavy and indulgent. So you're learning all of this subconsciously, right? Or for example, like the ice cream, it's sunny and you eat ice cream, you don't get sick while you're eating ice cream in the daytime. But also things like my mother would say that, hey, you know, come back from the playground when I was a young girl, before you see, like when you see the bats, you know, weaving through the sky. Back then, yes, bats still would make their way during the evening. And so, and then I also noticed, oh my God, like these bats that are out during the winter months at 6:30 and in the summer months, not until 8 o'clock. So I learned about the seasons. I learned about the rhythms of the day. I learned about the rhythms of a human being, even bio-individuality. Each one of us, 7 children in the house, each one of us was treated uniquely. As in, if there was like one of my cousins, she was always, and every time she went out in the sun, you know, she was asked to be extra careful or drink coconut water and, you know, brace herself because her body would overheat. She would become all red and she would get a headache. And I had other problems. So I understood that how every person on the planet is different. I also understood that there's some rhythms out there, seasonal rhythms, daily rhythms, and that the universe has this order of movement and we're all so connected. And it's really learning how to live in these rhythms that really amounts to health. But what happened, Melanie, as a result, you know, somebody could think that my upbringing was restrictive. It was actually very, very liberating. Because when you understand the rules of the universe, you basically also understand how and when you can bend them. How much can you play? When can you play? So I would say that growing up, health to me was, and even today continues to be, it is the freedom that comes from feeling well. It is not the fear of disease. Unfortunately, I see too many people look at health as a fear of disease. It's just the most liberating aspect of this human life when you can enjoy being well. So that was a gift and a legacy that was passed on to me by my grandfather before I even got a formal education. And it made me very curious. You know, I was already a very sensitive child. And the running joke is that I constantly asked myself this question, what makes people sick and what makes people tick? But that's what I was looking around me, and my family was my playground. It was my research laboratory. I was preoccupied by this 24/7. And then I had no choice, but I had to get a formal education and I'd rather to take this even further.
Wow. I love it so much. Actually, I had a flashback while you were saying that because when I read the part in the book about the bats, I was like, wait, bats? Like, I was like, this is such a different experience. I think I remember in my life the one time I saw a bat in the, like, in the air, and I freaked out.
That's so funny. And Melanie, I didn't grow up in a village or anything. I grew up in a very urban city, Bombay, Mumbai, you know, and it's as urban as New York is. And believe it or not, like, even when I was growing up, there were bats weaving through the sky. Like, that happened regularly. And I think today that doesn't happen, right? Just because we've just urbanized our cities so much that there is no place for some of these species on the planet, you know, in our around where we live.
Yeah, it's wild. Oh my goodness. Okay, really random tangent question. Do animals as well experience these different states of being kind of like the doshas and then suffer with unbalance? Or do you think that's more a human thing that has come about because of civilization and modern life?
I think animals don't suffer or are not meant to suffer as much as humans because they're not living out of balance by choice. The reason why they're suffering is because what we're giving, you know, how we've altered the environment, how their ecosystem has changed because of us, not because of their own personal choices. In fact, Melanie, this is such a great question that you've brought up because I talk about it all the time, that animals still have their instincts intact, right? Like, deer does not need testing, scientific testing, to know whether grass is better for the deer or eating a fruit in the morning is better. Like, deer wake up every day grazing on the same patch of land, grass, you know, the same, and they know they don't need testing for it. Or for example, deer, you know, bears, and I've seen this myself in Alaska, before bears go into hibernation, they eat big cabbage heads because they want to have a bowel movement once they're out of hibernation. Animals pick nursing mammals will pick galactagogue foods and plants because they want to nurse better. Or animals that are bruised will roll themselves in sulfur-rich soil, no experiments needed, because they want to heal better. So animals really have their instincts in their natural state. They don't have an intellect, so they're not confused. They're not always deciding. But in that instinct that we've lost as humans, they are able to make the right decisions for themselves as long as their ecosystem is uncompromised. Now, unfortunately, that is not the case. Their ecosystem is compromised, and thus they probably also suffer the way we do.
Okay. Yeah, that completely makes sense. So a question related to that, it relates a little bit to what you're saying, because you mentioned how, you know, health is not just the absence of disease. And you say something in the book about how true balance is not, it's not just a lack of imbalance. There's something more than that. And I'm perplexed or curious about the intuitive role of the quote ideal state. And what I mean by that is you talk a lot in the book about how this ideal inner climate in Ayurveda is this warm, moist climate, and that people's inner climates can vary from that. So they could be hot and dry and cold and, you know, not that ideal state. So for me, the reason I'm so interested by this is I feel like I love cold. So like I intuitively love like dry and cold. And I actually like the idea of like warm and moist to me inside feels like it's not, I don't feel like it's something I'm intuitively seeking. So does that mean that I'm just coming from an unbalanced state, and so I'm seeking this other unbalanced state rather than seeking the true balanced state? When we're born, are we balanced and then we become unbalanced? I'm just really intrigued by the intuitiveness of this.
Yeah. And you know, see, I tell you, intuition, Melanie, is such a vague word in our times because we are so far off from our intuition, right? We've gone so far into the dark tunnel of our intellect that honestly, intuition is rarely accessible to us unless we create a framework around it. And I think part of the book, it does do that. It wants to give you that path back to our intuition. But just in empty space, it's hard to really know whether it's an intuition, whether it's a craving, whether it's a conditioned desire. We're not quite sure. But when it comes back into something very specific, like, hey, you're craving something cold and dry, it could mean many things. Firstly, you could be looking at cold and dry differently from what I am. But the truth is that, yeah, chances are, and most people are out of balance. And we're most people are out of balance at birth, right? Because our parents had a certain environment, and the womb had a certain environment, and the egg and sperm had a certain quality. Because really, for the last 500 years, we really haven't lived in a place where just, you know, we were evolving to be a better species. In fact, we've just kind of been been threatened, you know, after we've become this Homo sapien and we started using our intellect and modernizing everything, in a way, you know, health has suffered slowly and steadily. So what our parents also carry is weakened genetic blueprints, and then we carry them with us. So it's rare that everybody is born with a whole perfect warm and moist homeostasis or the homeostatic environment inside. We're often off balance. And the chances are that if you're already on the hotter side, you might be craving more cooler things or cooler experiences, which, by the way, is almost everybody these days. People are burnt out, over-caffeinated. And even if it's not from any of these things, even if it's not from the burnout or the caffeine or the high stress, but the truth is that the entire world is leaning towards what I call this global warming inside. And therefore, they seek, you know, those who are in tune might actually seek cooler experiences, not necessarily cold, but that cooler would then bring them to warm and moist, right? Because if you're hot and you bring in something that feels cooling, you come back to warm.
How, because you mentioned like factors there, like caffeine, which would be a physical factor, and stress, which is a, you know, mental, emotional experience. Is one more powerful than the other as far as like the stress, the mindset, the pursuit of goals, those types of quote solar activities that you talk about in the book, compared to like the physical aspects, like the diet, the sleep, the exercise? Are they all like, is there a hierarchy of how these things affect us?
I think the hierarchy is in terms of who you are and how often you're engaging in any of that. So for example, I could very well say, hey, look, caffeine is the worst. But the truth is, if you're drinking caffeine, and by the way, it's not the worst, but just as an example, but if you're drinking caffeine once in a week, but you're chronically stressed the entire time, the all 7 days, that stress is a higher factor for you than the caffeine. But if there's somebody who's completely chilling and is not stressed at all, or like just this stress, let's say 1 out of 7 days something happens and, you know, experiences that stress is not a high factor for them, right? So it depends on the frequency. It depends on the intensity of engagement. And it also depends on where you're starting from, right? For example, Melanie, there could be somebody who's highly stressed, highly wrung, super busy, and one cup of caffeine could just get them really on that edge and all shaky and aggravate how they're already feeling, versus somebody who's super lethargic, sluggish, stuck in bed, you know, just so depressed, cannot get their eyes open. Actually, they could drink one cup of caffeine and it'll actually bring them a little bit towards the center, you know, get them a little stimulated. So it depends on who you are and the frequency of your, you know, interaction with any of these things, whether it's stress or caffeine or alcohol. So it's like you have to look at the picture, and, you know, it's an entire holistic picture and understanding of who you are and what you're interacting with.
That completely makes sense. So I actually, last night, I was getting on ChatGPT, and I was like, can you help me find my dosha? And it was asking me all these questions, and then I was telling it my answers.
Can I guess?
Yes, yes.
Pitta Vata?
Yes, like exactly.
So it's that hot and dry, right, Melanie? It's the hot and dry inner climate. And then the hot and dry inner climate would keep you craving cooler things.
Because it would ask me questions, and oftentimes it was two of the answers. So I would give it my hybrid answer. And it was this combination of Pitta Vata, like together. So for listeners, so that they can have a general idea, and listeners get the book, because, you know, all the information is in there and we can only briefly touch on things now. But the three different doshas, can you give a brief overview of them so people can hear them and feel what they might most identify with?
Yeah. And you know what, Melanie, I'm going to actually do this a little bit differently, because doshas are very often misunderstood in the world out there. Okay. So the thing is that our body is this massive system where things are always happening. I mean, imagine the complexity of this machinery called the human body, with digestion and hormones and sleep. And I mean, blood transportation and plasma and liver, all these things that happen, right? So for this body to actually exist in its function, there are three unique functions that are happening at all given points. One is, there is growth and building, right? Because you're building new cells and you have all these kind of, you know, protective growth mechanisms in the body, like your synovial fluid in your joints, your mucosal lining, your saliva. These are all these protective fluids that are kind of filling cavities, and they're more like building substances, right? But then also with these metabolic beings, right? Like there's mitochondria in the cell, that's kind of this powerhouse of energy, and there's hormones and digestion. And if you look at all of these activities, they're kind of like warm activities. They're metabolic. They're like metabolic, and they allow some kind of transformation to happen. So our body also needs this massive transformation function, which is usually heat-led. And then the third thing is, you know, what's not used needs to be evacuated in the body. Substances need to move, be thrown out. Cells need to be atrophy, like cells start atrophying. What you don't use, get flushed out of your body. So there's this whole movement and evacuation function in the body. So all our bodies experience this at all points. There's some building and protective functions that are happening. There's transformation functions that are happening. And then there's movement and decay evacuation function that is happening. And that's what really keeps our body moving in this perfect way that it does. Now, each one of these three is supported by something called a dosha. And let's just, for lack of a better word, this is what the Ayurvedic sages or scientists used. So all building functions in the body are supported by kapha dosha. And kapha dosha allows for your joints to have synovial fluids, your lining to have mucus, the cytoplasm of an innate cell, the saliva, good fat in your body, anything that's kind of, you know, padded and white and slimy and just like really cushioning your system. And they all look like, they all basically, my visual imagination of kapha is aloe vera, whether it's your plasma, it's your lymph, it's your synovial fluid, it's your mucosal lining, saliva, they all are kind of, you know, that same consistency. And you, these are amazing building elements, right? And then, so that's kapha dosha. And we all need kapha dosha to continue to build. The second is pitta dosha, which allows the heat-led transformation to happen in the body, which means digestion, hormones, thinking, thoughts, all the other heat-led, conception, reproduction, your menstruation, anytime, you know, just the interaction of you with the sun. So when you have melanin in your skin, those are all transformative metabolic processes dominated by pitta. They allow for us to keep moving forward. And then the third, you know, think of it like the wind, like your blood can go anti-gravity and then bowels can be evacuated. You can push a baby out. Things dry up in the body and they're flushed. And that is governed by vata. And this creates this perfect order in the human body. However, if they're all functioning appropriately, you're gold. Your body is doing really well. Most of us are imbalanced in these functions. So those who have an exaggerated kapha function, exaggerated building function, they might notice that their body likes to just build more. They may be more sluggish. They may be more like dense in their bodies, may have plaque, cholesterol, obesity. They may be pre-diabetic or diabetic. They may be bigger framed. So they're suffering from what we can call a kapha imbalance, a building imbalance. That there are people that have this kind of excessive heat, more pitta in their system. Those who have increased pitta, you know, so kapha is anabolic, pitta is metabolic. You know, they have more metabolic activities. They may be hot in their heads. They may be sharper, maybe more focused. They may have more burning in their digestion, maybe even acidity. And they may eat something and they may burn it out very quickly. But they may also experience burnout in their mind. They may be sensitive to the sun. They may have like rash. They may break into rashes easily. So they have that kind of heat. All symptoms say heat, even low-grade inflammation or just regular inflammation. So those, you can say that you're, you know, people who are like that have a pitta imbalance. People who have a vata imbalance, think of just like wind all over their bodies. They could be more depleted, more frail, dry, anxious, bloated, dry hair, dry skin, and they could have a vata imbalance. All of these states, when any of these three have an exaggerated function, whether it's the growth and building or it's the metabolic activity or the catabolic vata, it means you've basically gone off balance and you need to come back to all of these three working in perfect harmony.
This is, yeah, so amazing. I'm so impressed that you nailed me so quickly. In your life, do you tend to oscillate towards one or the other when you go out of balance?
I do. I would say definitely for me as well, it is easier for me to get overheated, to have a pitta imbalance. That is my natural tendency, which means your natural tendency is something that you're basically born with, the imbalance kind of that you're born with, that your womb gifted you, you know, just genetically or through your experience of being in your mother's uterus for 9 months. And I'd say for me, I can see that I can get overheated rather quickly or dry sometimes rather quickly. And knowing that allows me to stay in the center, allows me to brace myself when any of those things are happening.
Is there a reason, because you're mentioning this nourishing role of fats, and something I'm interested by or curious about is, because when I think fats, I would think like the kapha state, like the dense and, you know, like the, I don't know, it just seems like it would be that sort of thing. But it seems like fats, the quote good fats, like ghee and dairy and sesame seed oil and things, that those exist in this inner balance state. Is there a reason for that, like this focus on fats?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, somebody who has a lot of building going on, who's in a very kapha state, you're absolutely right. They can't, for them, they cannot afford the same amount of good fats that somebody who's, you know, experiencing a pitta or a vata imbalance. And I like to use the word inner climate. So I'm just because it becomes more comprehensible. So somebody in the kapha state has a cold and sluggish body. And if you have a cold and sluggish body, fat might make you a little bit more sluggish. But if you have a hot body, hot and dry body, you need those good fats as cushion. I mean, think about it, like if you have a bruise, right, like on the outside, if it's a hot bruise, and if you put like something like ghee, something that's like nice and padded, it's almost going to help support it. You know, it's going to lessen the feeling of heat on that bruise when you apply something that's very gentle and nourishing. Even like a Neosporin has that same aspect, that same quality. Even aloe vera has that similar quality. And good fats are extremely important. They are our fuel. You know, I say that, especially for women, we can see this very drastically, right? When we're young and adolescents, we kind of have this like taut skin and we just, everything is stretched out. And then when we hit, you know, our postmenopausal, perimenopausal years, it's like we go, this journey is from a grape to a raisin, right? We lose all of that. We lose, and we don't lose water really, yeah, right? We lose all that good protein and fat in our body and we become dry. And really, like drying, I always say this, drying is dying. You know, autumn is dry. Like anytime things happen, like if a fruit is like coming to its, you know, it's just kept outside forever, it starts to dry up before it decays fully. So drying is really dying for everything on this planet. Like if you have flowers at home, somebody gives you flowers, you'll see that when before they die, they start to dry. So it is very important, the role of fats, and it doesn't always mean through oral administration, and not everybody can digest the same level of fats, but including fats in some manner or the other, whether it's through oil application on your skin, whether it's through other oiling rituals, whether it's through good fats in your foods that you're able to break down effectively. Fats become very, very important when it comes to longevity, youth, maintaining our vitality.
Yeah, so I guess we could kind of say that, like, when the whole low-fat zeitgeist was in, that the dietary culture was going more Vata then. Would that be right? Like a low-fat type paradigm?
Completely dry, and you know, and that drying leads to anxiety, lack of sleep. You don't have like all the good juices that you need to repair and rebuild your body, what I call lunar juices. They all require that good fat. And when people go very dry, it's like they're dehydrated from, you know, just the sun dehydrates us, like your body feels dehydrated. And then in that state, you can't achieve full rest. Like your eyes are red and your throat feels like, painful almost, you know, just dry all the time. Your ears, you cannot even tolerate noise, excessive noise. And it starts there, but it can become a deeper imbalance very quickly. Your microbiome starts to shift in your gut. You get constipated, bloated, all of those things happen.
Hey friends, I'm about to tell you how to get 10% off the ideal coffee when it comes to supporting your health. So if you guys know me, you know I am obsessed with optimizing basically everything I consume, and that especially relates to coffee. Did you know that coffee is one of the most powerful sources of antioxidants in the modern diet? And yet, not all coffee is created equal. Between sourcing, farming practices, roasting, and contaminants, there can be a huge difference in the health impact of the coffee that you drink. That is exactly why I created Glow Coffee. Glow Coffee is a premium, specialty-grade Arabica coffee sourced from sustainable women-led farms in Colombia. It's organically grown, and we third-party test it meticulously, like every single lot, for purity. And what makes Glow especially exciting from a biohacking perspective is that we specifically made it to be rich in chlorogenic acid, or CGA. That's one of coffee's primary, most potent antioxidant compounds that has been studied for its role in metabolic health, inflammation, oxidative stress, and so much more. The elevation levels of the beans, how they're grown, and how they're roasted all affect CGA levels. So we searched high and low to find the perfect beans naturally high in CGA and tested them to confirm that, and then we roast those beans to preserve the CGA content. and then test after that as well. Coffee is already one of the potentially biggest contributors of antioxidants in the human diet, so I designed Glow Coffee to maximize those benefits while keeping it incredibly clean and high quality. And this coffee is so clean. It's grown organically, of course, but then we go even farther than that. We third-party test the beans for almost 100 toxic compounds, including pesticides, heavy metals, and mold. Oh, and perhaps the best part is it is absolutely delicious. We're talking smooth, low bitterness. It's honestly the exact coffee I personally want to drink every single day of my life. It's so bright, smooth, and delicious that it's also perfect black for fasting. No added sweeteners or cream needed. You can also splash it on your face for an antioxidant-rich toner. I do that every single day. After the sauna, after the shower, all the things. I created Glow Coffee because it's really about upgrading one of our most common daily habits into something that truly supports your health and performance. You can get 10% off with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at glowcoffeeco.com. That's 10% off Glow Coffee with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at glowcoffeeco.com. Are you ready to glow inside and out? Fuel your day, illuminate your way. That's glowcoffeeco.com. It was just so interesting to see just how integrated oil was into all these different practices. And you have a section where you go through different Ayurvedic rituals, and a lot of them involve oil. I was interested to see like which ones I was already doing. The ones I was already doing were like, I scrape my tongue every morning, and then I do the oil swishing. I've been doing that since, oh my goodness, so long. I literally can't imagine my life without it. Basically, once I wake up and I put a lot of oil in my mouth, and I use MCT oil, and then I like take a shower and like do things. And yeah, it's amazing for me. But the other ones, the foot massage and like the hair oil massage and like the nose oil. So these different practices, do you do all of them?
I don't do all of them. I actually do the nose oiling. I do the body oiling. That's kind of non-negotiable for me. But the oil pulling, I don't do every single day, I'll be honest with you. And I'm also very kind and gentle with people I work with. I'm like, you know, meet yourself where you're at and gradually build up. So I'm better about oil pulling than I was in the past. But the body oiling, I do Abhyanga, I do all the time. And the Nasya, I do quite often as well. The oil pulling, I'm getting better with. Hair oiling, I do twice a week minimum. And I love that, my favorite practice. There's lots of others, like there's like oil enemas, and there's vaginal oiling, which has not even made it to the book. But I love those practices as well.
Oh, wow. So I am so, I guess, happy to hear you say that, because I think people can get overwhelmed, you know, like there's all these things that you have to do. And so hearing from you, who like you're at the top of the sphere, that, you know, not even you are doing all these things every day, I think that's really empowering for people to find what works for them, you know, go slow, like you said, and work it into their life in a way that's sustainable. So that's amazing to hear. Yeah, I have no experience with this hair oiling situation. I was like, what is this? So can you tell listeners a little? I think there's a few of them that are more foreign to some of us. So yeah, the hair oiling. And I would love to hear more about that, because you said the non-negotiables for you were the body oiling and the hair oiling.
Yeah. Hair oiling is a divine practice. It moves your life from an ordinary life to an extraordinary life. That's how much I love it.
Big statement. Okay, I'm excited.
So basically, I'll say that what hair oiling does, it's extremely nourishing for your nervous system. You basically oil the scalp. And I would highly recommend that, if this was a video podcast, I'd show you how to do it. But I would recommend that you want to go on YouTube, find somebody of my ethnicity, find somebody who's in the field for a while and showing you a video on hair oiling. I actually have something on my Instagram as well. And the way you do this is you kind of warm hair oil. And now it's become a trend in the West as well. So there's a lot of hair oils, even though I prefer traditional ones. I don't like the hair oils, which have like 100 ingredients. You can just get plain sesame oil and that's enough. And there's some other Ayurvedic hair oils, which are just herbal oils. Nothing should be added to it. There should be no ingredient which is not botanical on that bottle. And you just warm up the oil by just putting the bottle in warm water if you can. And if you can't, then you don't have to warm it. And then you use a dropper and you apply it. You part your hair and you apply drops of oil everywhere. And then you rub it in. And then you claw your fingers and then you massage your scalp. And it is so relaxing. I'll be honest, like, in our tradition, you do this for each other. So like mothers, grandmothers did it for grandchildren. There were helpers in the house who did it for us. And like sometimes I have this lady who comes to cook food for us and she's the one who'll do it for me. And so you basically, it's that something that you pass on. Like I will do this for my daughters. I will oil their hair. And it is just, it's so nourishing, not only for your nervous system. It basically is the food for your hair. It depends on the oil you use. It can prevent graying of hair. Like I'm 43. I don't have any gray hair yet. I have one strand that came about sometime and it's just that one strand so far. So you want to actually, and it does a lot for your hair, does a lot for your scalp, for your nervous system, for all of it. People don't realize that really the life of your hair is not on the hair. It's actually inside the hair follicle, the sebum that holds the hair in place, that nourishes everything. And then as we age and all the drying that happens as a result of stress, staying up, all exposure to the sun, that sebum starts to dry out. So you want to actually go and replenish it. And hair oiling is that divine practice.
Wow. Okay. And then you wash it off?
And then, yeah, so you can keep it on for 20 minutes. You can keep it on for 2 hours. If you're seasoned like me, you can even keep it overnight sometimes, right? I mean, just be prepared to like have an extra pillow cover, pillowcase for your pillow so that you're not staining on them. And you don't have to put a ton of oil. You could just put very little. You can just start with like 1 teaspoon or 1 tablespoon. Somebody like me now probably does 3 tablespoons and I have a little below shoulder length hair. I'm used to that. So I can deal with 3 tablespoons of oil. But you can start small. You can keep it for 20 minutes, then move to 2 hours, and then move to, maybe overnight if you'd like.
And you said this is, a cultural tradition that happens growing up for boys and girls?
Yeah, everybody.
Oh, wow. What if you're bald? Should you oil your head?
Yeah, it's such a nourishing practice for your scalp and just your nervous system and all of that. You can still do it. If you're bald, great.
Okay, this is exciting. I need to try this.
I know you're not bald, Melanie.
And then, so ghee, there's a lot in the book about ghee. And I think a reason this is really intriguing is dairy is so debated, like controversial. Some diets eschew it completely. Some, obviously, Ayurvedic, ghee is amazing. So this role of ghee in particular, why is it this ideal fat?
So it's one of the ideal fats. And you're right? Like dairy is very controversial. It's very controversial because certain traditions like Ayurveda, when they talked about dairy, they were talking about a different cow. They were talking about this cow. If you look at like a traditional Indian gir cow that we call G-I-A-R, they had a little hump and it was a very skinny cow. It's just exclusively grass fed and gave A2 milk. And it was lighter milk with a different type of protein composition. And that's great, right? Like that's great. And plus milk was never, when I was growing up, I would not even imagine that somebody would drink milk cold from the refrigerator. I mean, milk, whether it's from the breast or it's from the udder, it's meant to be warm. And if it's not warm, then you warm it up because you know that warmth is important. Unless it's warm, how can it transform? So that warmth is important for the milk fats to start breaking down. So growing up, we drank spiced milk, spiced and hot milk, or if it was not spiced, then it was at least boiled and then slightly cooled so we could just drink it without burning our throats. But ghee is a whole another level, right? Because dairy can be tricky for a lot of people. It can feel explosive. But what ghee does, right? Ghee basically changes the composition of the milk. So you know, it's like even lactose intolerant people can actually have. And the casein is also very different. It's very low in casein. So the two substances that make milk so difficult to digest are basically absent, pretty much absent, in the ghee. So it can be tolerated much better. But also ghee is fermented. When it's done right, it's cultured. I shouldn't say fermented, it's cultured, which means a culture is added in the making of the process of ghee. And the minute you culture something, you make it more digestible. You're giving it this kind of warm and moist bacteria, probiotic experience. That's why it's the only fat that is Mayo Clinic has called it the gut butter, that how can a fat be good for your gut? Because it has this cultured aspect of it. But not only that, right? Like, look, yes, we are not like other mammals. No other mammal drinks milk from another mammal, but no other mammal is on the phone and on the computer and walking on 2 legs like that. So we're unique. Yeah. And what makes us unique is how we eat is actually what led to our evolution. And we've relied upon a mammal's milk. Like our body knows how to use a mother's milk to break it down and to create new tissue. So our body has the memory. Cow's milk comes kind of close to that. And cow's milk, because it can be heavy because of the lactose and the casein, you create ghee out of it. So you still get some of the benefits of that. It's coming from a mammal that your body understands how to break it down, but you kind of modify it and you make it into ghee, which is further more digestible.
Amazing. Yeah. Yeah. That is often the argument that's used, is that we didn't, or that no other animal, you know, consumes milk. Okay. And okay. So while we're in this world of food and cooking and things, so you have two core principles about cooking. One involves the warm, moist state of the food, and one involves cooking versus raw. And so here's another thing where, you know, there are so many very conflicting ideas out there, because there are people on raw diets who they say that that's the most cleansing thing ever. And then people who say you should have, you know, fruit all the time or fruit for breakfast. And you talk a lot about this in the book, like the importance of cooking and, you know, how raw can actually potentially be detrimental to our digestive state, and how we, you know, should not have a breakfast of fruit. So some questions there, I guess. One would be, people who experience seemingly health benefits on like a all raw diet or a heavy fruit diet, like, what do you think is happening there? Are they coming from a state of imbalance and that's why it's helping them?
So I will say, for a certain period of time, if you're, you know, especially if your body's sluggish and you've had a lot of cheesy foods, fatty foods, you've had a sedentary lifestyle, and you have, like, think about your body just having all this goo and slime and it needs soaking up. And then when you have some raw foods and raw salads or raw green juices, even for some amount of time, you can feel like, you know, it kind of goes into your system, and these are drier. They don't have so much, they don't have inherent fats in them, these foods. It can feel a little better. People can see lowered cholesterol. People can see lowered sugar, blood sugar, and they can see all of that for a short period of time. Long period, they start to notice that their microbiome has changed and their gut is not as comfortable. And I've seen plenty of people who felt like they were doing great on juicing, for example, and now are suffering tremendously. And, you know, I did a post, and you had to see how many people felt validated, saying that, yes, we felt better for a short period of time, but then we felt like it was just the worst thing for our gut. So, you know, in Ayurveda, you would just not even do something that can have a long-term impact. You just wouldn't. I mean, it's designed to not have these side effects at all. And there are many other ways of achieving the same results. But I would say that it's also a matter of simple research, right? I mean, today it's so easy to do research. If anybody just even does a simple Google search of what led to our evolution, you know, 300,000 years ago, when man started using fire to cook their foods, we just changed. That's when we became this exact species that we are today, where we got on our two feet and our gut became smaller, our brains became bigger. We developed what's called the intellect, because digestion didn't take so much energy. To digest, to break down raw foods, I mean, we all eat foods. Whatever you eat, whether it's raw or cooked, it needs to come out of your system looking like the same thing, like everybody's feces, you know, falls in the same, like, in a range. The amount of work your gut has to do to break down something raw. Cooking activates life, right? So for example, if you cook something, you'll see that it almost starts decaying much quicker. You have a zucchini that's raw, you keep it outside, it's not going to decay that quickly. But the minute it's cooked, like, you cannot even eat it next day, because you've activated life. Like, it's almost like you've given birth to that food. Like, it's the prana or the life force is now active and it's ready to be received. So everything, right, whether it's the understanding of the prana or the life force, or it's even just a matter of simple research to see how human beings started cooking their foods and how their bodies changed as a result. And then also imagining, right, if you were stuck in a forest or on an island which had amazing vegetables and fruits, I mean, after day six, would you really feel that nourished or comforted? You probably wouldn't, right? Like, for a short period of time, you can imagine that comfort. But human beings, we need those other nourishing foods. And if you also look back at cultures that did eat raw salads, they always paired it with fermented vinegar or olive oil, and both, combination of both, you know, some sort of olive oil and lemon juice, which is, again, warm and moist. And I'm not going to give it all away in the podcast. I mean, if you want me to, I will. But just, I don't want to go into the explanation of warm and moist in this particular answer. But basically, people added things that already started the breakdown of that raw substance so that when they ate it, it wasn't that hard to digest. And salads were usually eaten as a side. So there is a lot of evidence pointing to it. The last part I'll say to this is if you look at what people ate in the blue zones, almost none of the blue zones ate just raw food, fruit for breakfast. In fact, most blue zones didn't even eat fruit for breakfast. They and some ate some berries and a little bit here and there, always paired with something else. So this whole idea of raw fruit is quite like raw fruit first thing in the morning. You can eat raw fruit second thing in the morning, and that's fine. But as first thing in the morning is just fairly new, actually, maybe about 50, 60 years old. And it's great as a replacement for what America had started to eat in terms of, you know, once industrialization happened, like raw cereals and Pop-Tarts and all of those things, and started being, you know, we experienced this epidemic of metabolic syndrome. And that's when, you know, it's definitely better than any of those foods. But if you have to just look at it in the ideal world, it's not.
Okay. Yeah, this is so, so fascinating. And speaking of cooking, you have a section on the refrigerator. So when we put food into the refrigerator, how does that affect? Does it pause the state of the food? Does it get rid of the benefits of the food? What happens with that preservation method?
I love these questions. You're being so, you know, deep and specific. I love it. So we want to remember that refrigeration is fairly new, right? Like, and we also want to remember that chronic disease is also, you know, in the last, since the 1930s and 1940s, suddenly we've had this crazy rise in chronic disease, and much more so in the last 50 years. And we also want to remember that refrigerator, so chronic disease, electricity was also urbanized our homes in that exact same time, 1930, 1940s, when electricity came into urban homes. Eventually we had refrigeration, and something happened and suddenly things went downhill. So refrigeration is quite new. Listen, I have a refrigerator and it's full of things. So let me give you a disclaimer that I'm not suggesting you throw away your refrigerator. But what is it that you keep inside your refrigerator? Because it temporarily pauses, it holds. It's like a morgue for your foods, you know. Think about it like a morgue or like a life support system where you kind of like are saying, hey, life, you know, you stop functioning for a little bit. Let's just like put you in this morgue and freeze you, make you a fossil, and then reactivate you. The reactivation is not quite the same, especially for cooked foods. The refrigerator can be a great place for condiments, for fresh foods that you haven't yet used and cooked, you know, just because, unfortunately, out of convenience, you would keep it. But the minute you cook it and you've already activated that entire life force in the food and you put it back in the refrigerator, it's going to lose its vitality.
Okay, that is so interesting. It's interesting to me, especially because I never thought about it in that way before. The reason I historically did not like the idea of like cooking meat, for example, and then putting in the refrigerator and then having it later was because it would accumulate excess histamine. That was like my focus. It's so interesting, this idea of what happens to it when it's cooked. So it sounds like I am okay with, like, I have a lot of frozen, uncooked, like seafood and meat in a chest freezer. Is that okay? And then it's uncooked and then I thaw it and cook it?
Yeah. See, look, at some point, everything is okay. And you do, like, look, ideally, Melanie, you and I and everybody should be living on farms and, like, you know, look, that is not what's happening. So we all pick our evils. We all pick how far do we want to go. And for me, my recommendation is like your vegetables and fruits, and, you know, while they're uncooked, you can keep it, like vegetables more so in the refrigerator. Meats, you're right, like with histamines. And it's the same thing. It's basically losing the vitality of life. And, you know, chemically, it can sometimes look like, you know, added histamines, or it can look like another, like it can look like bacteria or mold or whatever that is. So I would say that it depends from, you know, food to food. And if your seafood is packaged, kept in such a way that it kind of preserves its life force, that's fine. But once it's cooked, I would highly recommend then discarding it if there's extras.
Well, something that's interesting is, so even though I like I said, I have a lot of frozen meat and seafood, and still intuitively, I just feel the need. I have to go to the grocery store every single day. Like every day I have to go. I don't want it delivered. I want to go, because there's something about I want to go. It just feels evolutionarily right for me to go procure or secure or like hunt or gather my food, even if it's just going to the grocery store. But yeah. And my dad has the same habit. So I'm like, did I inherit that from him?
Definitely did. Yeah. Love it.
while we're also speaking about meal timing or meals and meal timing and composition, so I was very interested to read about the different amount and timing of different meals, because I'm also the host of the Intermittent Fasting podcast. So we talk a lot about eating windows, and something I've become super aware of in my own life, other people's lives, and listeners' lives is some people really seem to gravitate towards eating earlier. Some people gravitate towards just eating consistently throughout the day. Some people gravitate towards eating later. I'm such a night girl. I mean, in the book, you say that we, you know, are meant to be more supper people than dinner people. And the thing that made me happy was that, you know, breakfast like a king, you kind of say how that might not intuitively be the way we're supposed to be eating. So that lined up with me. But then I do tend to eat a very big, you know, feast meal every night. So my questions here are, well, one, earlier you were saying about how fire and cooked foods helped make us human. Does that mean with fire and cooked foods, though, were we cooking around fire at night and eating, you know? I'm just trying to like justify what I do. Basically, in Ayurveda, what is the quote ideal meal timing and literal amount of the meals? How does that line up ancestrally? Were we cooking around the fire at night? What are your thoughts there?
Sure. In the winter, we were cooking around fires at, you know, once it became dark, which is 3, 4, 5. And if you were in Iceland, you would still at 3 o'clock be lighting a fire and cooking probably. But, you know, I mean, before we go even into Ayurveda, Melanie, I just always like, and you probably read this in the book, right? But I always like to remind ourselves that we are diurnal mammals, right? We wake up with the sun and we sleep with the sun. And tremendous research is being done now to see what is the biochemistry of the body through the day. And so many of our biochemicals and neurotransmitters, they actually align with the sun. So if we work with the sun and we see that nocturnal mammals, like a tiger can eat at night and digest it perfectly, for example, but the deer will wake up in the morning to eat, we also have that similar clock. And when the sun is at its peak, so lunchtime is when we will digest our best. And like the research has been done now to show that our insulin sensitivity is the highest during noon, which means we are like, you can break down sugars the best. But also gastrin, which is your digestive, you know, a strong digestive enzyme, is the highest during noon. The other thing is that your cortisol is high in the morning, and then it's kind of gradually, you know, going down. Your body starts to relax. Great time to eat food because your body is not in that fight or flight mode. Cortisol is typically a little bit higher first thing in the morning just because your body needs you to be up and like concerned about the day. So it's very natural for that to happen. So if you know, I've mapped this out and I look at all the neurotransmitters and the enzymes that exist in our body that support digestion, and you will find that window between 12 and 2 to be a beautiful time with maximum support to break down your sugar. Your hunger hormone, ghrelin, is just on its rise. So you're not, if it's very high, like at nighttime, ghrelin becomes much higher. So you crave starchy foods. The hunger hormone loves starchy foods and heavy foods and denser foods, the higher it is. But mid-afternoon, it's just in that right level. So you eat the food that you can break down easily. The same quantity of food eaten at night cannot be broken down as effectively because at night we become more insulin resistant rather than sensitive. Now, the good news is if you're used to doing something for a long period of time, your body probably has evolved. You know, like our bodies love to support us. You gotta just give it consistency. I'm sure, I don't know if you've heard of these stories, Melanie, but I've heard of stories where people smoked for 50 years, they quit, and then they died the year right after because the body kind of adjusted to that smoking. So, I mean, it's if you only want to keep a limited number of vices and then let your body adjust to them and keep everything else very consistent. But if you are really used to eating dinner and that's your, you know, that's what you feel good about, then, you know, maybe it's not hurting your body that much. But otherwise, the universal law is that we're diurnal mammals. The scientific law is that every chemical, biochemical that helps you to digest better is at its best during noon. And ancestrally, without electricity, people were not having big dinner parties. The whole idea of eat your soup, you know, we started eating our soup because it felt like dinner or stews and, you know, out of these stone pots. That's what most of our, and, you know, sometimes it was bone broths in the winter. That's how our ancestors ate. That's how, unless it was a feast, dinner was not a main meal for anybody.
Hi, friends. Would you like to have the most epic eating experience? I'm talking eradicate bloating and better absorb your nutrients. If so, you need digestive enzymes. These are one of my most favorite supplements out of everything I take, and I truly cannot imagine my life without them. Digestive enzymes are key to break down your food into usable nutrition and to stop things like bloating, digestive distress, constipation, all the things. That's why I created Avalon X Digest. And you can get 10% off with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at avalonx.us. You can also get a subscription and save 15%, which you can pause or cancel at any time. Friends, I worked so hard to create the perfect blend of enzymes for Avalon X Digest. It's a full-spectrum, plant-based enzyme blend with proteases to help you break down protein, amylase for carbs, lipase for fats, cellulase for fiber, and so much more. In fact, there are 13 different types of enzymes in this blend. I cannot tell you how many people have told me that when they take Avalon X Digest, they experience no digestive distress with meals. These are truly game changers. And for any of you guys looking to up your protein intake, Avalon X Digest will help you actually break down and assimilate your protein so you get more protein from your meals. I wanted to create the highest potency enzymes so that you get all of these benefits when you eat with no problematic fillers or ingredients. Avalon X Digest is also tested multiple times for purity and potency, comes in glass bottles, and is truly the best enzymes on the market. And again, you can get 10% off with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at avalonx.us.
Yeah, I'm so fascinated by this entire topic, and I have been for years and years. And I remember I actually did a really long blog post a few years ago, and I went and I tried to research like every single food-related hormone, similar to what you were just talking about, and like when is insulin peak, when is ghrelin peaking, all these different things, and what does it objectively seem to say is the best time to eat. And what I walked away from doing it then was that the morning does not seem to be the time to eat. You know, cortisol's high, right? You know, it's breaking down endogenous fuel in our body so we can go out and, you know, find the food. And I walked away with like late afternoon, like early evening hormones seemed to work well, but definitely when the sun was up, like not when the sun was down. It's interesting. Also, I also read a study. It was interesting to hear you say about the body adapting, and but you know, we don't want to have like all the vices and then adapting to all of them. But I did read a study, and I've been looking for it ever since because I reference it a lot. But it looked at people who ate at night and whether or not they had digestive distress from it. And basically it was an adaption thing. So if people who had been doing it didn't report having GI issues, but if people like switched to it, they did. So, but then again, we don't necessarily want to be forcing our body into something that, you know, it is maybe not, quote, supposed to be doing ideally. This is just so interesting to me. Have you been, so for you, did you ever identify, like, were you like a breakfast person, a dinner person? Like, what were you like growing up?
Honestly, Melanie, I pretty much live like this. So I always ate, lunch was always my biggest meal.
So intuitively, you were in the thing.
Because I grew up with this. I grew up with this science, right? Also, I do want to say that, you know, when I see women hit perimenopause and menopause, and then their bodies change drastically, just by like dropping that dinner to like a soup, down to a soup or some side of veggie, my God, their life changes. Miracles happen.
Wow. Also, while we're talking about food, a myth that was dismantled a bit, that you dismantled a bit in the book, was raising kids and diet. And you talk about how I think there's often this idea out there that we need to like feed kids all the things all the time and they need to eat everything. And so how, from an Ayurvedic approach, how would diet and food work with kids? And if a kid doesn't like a bitter food, for example, like they don't want to eat their broccoli, what does that mean?
Yeah, the kids are in the building stage, the growth stage of their life. And they need foods. They are attracted to foods which bring growth. So good complex carbohydrates, grains, rice, good fats, sweet potatoes, all of these are like those nice, heavy, dense building foods. So you and I both know that they do help to build tissue. Of course, we're not talking about unhealthy fats. We're not talking about margarine, processed fats. We're not talking about sugar, even though kids are attracted to that because they offer a similar taste. But they are going to be attracted to all these other foods as well. And if you offer a child spicy foods, they'll reject it almost right away. And I know in certain traditions, they want to encourage children to eat that, but their palates cannot take it. And they're meant to reject it because those spicy foods will speed up their metabolic activity. It's something that they're not ready for. They need metabolism to be at a certain pace so that they can hold on to that food and build more. Right? You and I eat the same meal that a little child does for the entire year if we just match our meals. We will see for sure that the child grows twice in size and you and I don't. So because their bodies are meant to be building. Spicy foods are not building. They're breaking down. Bitter foods are also drying in the body, and that doesn't help them. It doesn't help their cause. So they'll naturally gravitate towards the nourishing three tastes, which is sweet. When I say sweet, it's like sweet as in almonds, sweet as in coconuts, sweet as in sweet potatoes, not sweet as in sugar, but sweet taste. And then sour taste and salty taste. Those are the three nourishing tastes. And they'll naturally gravitate towards those three tastes because it'll help them to build their digestive enzymes and eat well and nourish their bodies.
Well, speaking of spices, so I eat so much ginger and turmeric and cumin. It's kind of crazy how much I eat. I just love that stuff. So spices, I've always been a little bit conflicted by as far as their warming versus cooling nature, because I had read that people in hot climates actually take in spices because it cools down the body because it makes you sweat. So what is the level of spices and this idea of them being warming or cooling? And does any food in or do foods in Ayurvedic medicine ever, because TCM, traditional Chinese medicine, also kind of looks at food this way. Are there any that conflict that they see differently?
No, it's actually remarkably similar. Very, very similar. I mean, it's just, yeah, because it's the wisdom of life. It's the same. You know, Hippocrates had stuff that was the same, because anybody who looked at life like that, anywhere on the planet, may have different names, but understood the same things. So I will say that most spices are warming. They can have a cooling impact on your body. So if something is warming and you consume it and it makes you sweat, now you've had a reaction which feels cooling, right? So it can cool down your system as a result of you breaking into a sweat because the heat is trapped inside. So you've kind of now opened a window, and that can happen, right? So you give it like this warm wind, which kind of opens a vent out. So there's an exhaust right there. But otherwise, spices will always support your digestive environment, but it can hurt your digestion. If it's overly heating, it can burn your mucosal lining. So I want to tell everybody, spice with caution. Spice your foods. Just don't do spices by themselves. There's certain spices like fennel seeds, for example, or cumin once it's soaked in water, that it changes its property once that happens. And it can have somewhat more of a cooling impact. Or like fennel has the fiber of the fennel seed for functions differently than the pulp inside the fennel seed. One is a little cooling, one is a little warming, because it is a spice after all. And because of that cooling fiber outside, its overall impact can be cooling.
Okay. Yeah. And now I'm thinking about my meal composition, and well, it's definitely not the ideal Ayurvedic meal. It's not a warm, moist meal, but I think I have a lot of spices, but then I have a lot of like pureed cucumber. So it's kind of like not canceling each other out, but I'm assuming that those interact on two different sides of the spectrum.
No, beautifully. They actually don't cancel each other. They support each other, because if cucumber is cooling and you're using a spice for it, then you're coming to warm and moist. You're actually coming to a warm place.
Okay. Well, okay. Maybe I am doing... Exciting. Oh, I have a really, really random question, but it was bothering me. So we're talking about these different stages of growth and transformation and decay. That's three. There's like three stages, three doshas, but there are four seasons. I like mathematically couldn't wrap my head around this. How do those line up?
Yeah. So the spring is your building season. It's the kapha season, right? Everything is building. Suddenly the earth is more wet and moist and everything is in growth stage. And the summer is transformation, right? Like there's fruits and flowers and like the full blown, like it's the full blown opposite of autumn and winter. Autumn and winter can be clubbed into one because it is a long transition from this budding life to all the way that third decay. So the decline, like think about think about autumn like your 40s and 50s, you know, where you're just like in perimenopause and menopause, and you're just like holding on to a little bit of youth and a little bit of decay, and like your body is going into somewhat of depreciation. And then think of winter like you're in your 70s.
Okay. Okay. That makes sense. Now the math works. And something I found fascinating in the book was, because you talk about the role of these cycles and the growth, transformation, decay, and how it repeats, and we see it in nature, and we just see it as this cycle. And that's, you know, naturally the way it happens. And then you make a comment about how something about how the repetition of the cycle isn't mandated, that it actually can continue on if it's not tied to like human things. But you use the example of like relationships and your career. So what is the role of this cycle and whether or not it repeats, and then how that relates to like your relationships and career and things like that?
So basically, I'm going to say like what the principle is first, and then how it differs for things that are not tangible and more subtle aspects, right? So everything in life, right? Like, so the seasons, for example, spring is building, summer is transforming, autumn and winter, everything dries and dies. If you get a fruit, you'll see the fruit is beginning to grow, like on the tree, it grows, it ripens, then it enters its transformation stage. And then if you don't eat it, it's going to decay, dry, and then, you know, just be destroyed completely. And we see this with every cell, right? Like a cell comes into its emergence and it does its metabolic whatever activity, and then the mitochondria finishes its role, the cell can die. So we see this everywhere, right? We see this with human life. We're born, we grow, we become reproductive beings, and then we decay and then we die. And this is great, right? Just as we wouldn't want our old cells to be hanging around, cells that have stopped functioning to be hanging around in the body, the universe doesn't want us long after our reproductive age to actually be hanging around on the planet, right? We need to go for the sake of the planet. But there are areas where this principle we are free of this principle. We're liberated from it. We're not tied to this principle. And those are subtle areas, intangible areas. For example, relationships, right? If you meet somebody and you're initially in the growth stage, and if there's enough growth and you've met enough times and there's excitement, then things start to heat up. And then it becomes like a transformation of sorts, right? If it's friendship, it becomes a ripe friendship. If it's a romantic relationship, you may decide to like get married, move in, have a child, any of those things, right? So you hit the transformation stage. And then very often people start taking things for granted at that point, right? They're like, okay, fine. And then the relationship goes into decay. But what if you were to think that you need to continue to grow in this relationship, you need to continue to build and do what you did in the initial days of the relationship, so it continues to transform into something new every day? And I think that's one of the biggest problems that I see in marriages with couples as well, right? Like they had that great time once upon a time, and then they decided to do something with it, and they transformed it into something beautiful, and then they just let it go. And the natural order of things will take it into decay if you don't continue to build and grow. And the same thing happens with our careers, right? Like we're building, we're all exciting, and then we hit a mark and we do something great with it. But if you don't, you know, we see organizations, large organizations, if they don't continue to innovate, grow, build, then they kind of go into decline and then they go. So, you know, with all intangible aspects of life, you want to continue to stay in the growth stage so that you can naturally keep transforming. So it's very, very important. And I do say that there's just one place where this principle just does not apply at all. And that is self-growth and spiritual growth. Because in that area, you grow, right? Like you grow, you transform. Of course, you transform. If let's say you're doing therapy or doing any kind of spiritual practice, you grow, you transform. And then you continue your practice and you had this endless transformation. And after that endless transformation, you keep on that endless transformation path. What happens is dissolution of ego. You dissolve your ego. You kind of just are, you know, you're one with the universe at that point. So that's, you know, that's a very promising purpose of human life. If everything I have here is going to go into these cycles of growth, transformation, decline, and everything physical, at least, like my parents will die, my kids will get older, I will die, all of those things will happen. But what is that area which continues to increase returns on my effort? And that is self-growth and, you know, spiritual work.
So fascinating. I love it. I was really excited to read that section, especially because I'm so like career driven and love pursuing my passion. So it was nice to hear I can, you know, not that I need permission, but that it can be beneficial to stay in that growth state. another topic we haven't touched on yet, I don't think, is exercise. And this was an exciting part about reading this part of the book is, I mean, exercise comes up on this show all the time, like all the time. It's a really big topic, and I'm very accustomed to reading a lot of, you know, similar advice and guidance and perspectives. And the two core principles that you highlight with exercise, like the two rules, quote rules, I don't think these have come up in any other book or show or interview. You know, they're just so, so different. So one was exercising to half of your capacity, and the other was the role of having oily, good fats to support. So could you talk about these two rules, which are just so new to me?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, Melanie, now they're talking more about like how, especially with women, to exercise in the zone two, you know, where you're not completely, where you can, I forget what it is, where you can hum but not sing or something like that, where you're not that breathless that you don't have, you know, words coming out of your mouth. So I love that. It's the same thing as zone two. I just love that how Ayurveda knew all of this before science, modern science.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. So it's kind of in that zone two area that you don't overdo it, because the truth is that when you do and you lose good soft tissue, you lose your lunar tissue in the body. You don't burn evenly when you're exercising. You burn all of it. You burn the good and the bad, and you burn your mucus lining, and you burn, you know, some of what keeps you in repair stage. So it is important to not overdo it. And I've seen people who've done long-term hot yoga, getting rheumatoid arthritis, etc., and not eating well, especially. So the second piece becomes that, you know, while you are depleting your body of all these lunar juices and you're breaking down your fats, but you're also breaking down some of the good stuff, you want to make sure that you are consuming good nourishing foods to replenish your body. And, you know, so many times I'll see people who've gone on the sudden exercise regimen and they've lost their period suddenly, you know, like periods just absolutely like estrogen, which is the most juiciest, which is what makes us juicy as women, gives us breasts and amniotic fluid and all of those good things. People see a decline in their estrogen and then they don't ovulate or they don't menstruate. And it's exactly this what is happening. Your juices kind of dry out. So it's very important to continue to consume good fats when you're working out.
And what is the role specifically on fats on the skin while exercising? Can that actually fuel the exercise?
Yeah, absolutely. It can fuel the exercise very, very well. It can help recovery. It can nourish your tissues. And the fat that Ayurveda talks about, the massage, the oil you use on your body, is sesame. And by the way, right now, you know, research is still pending on this. But the one thing that we know even here in the Western world and modern science is that sesame can help you balance your progesterone as well as estrogen. And estrogen is also anti-inflammatory as a hormone. And when you're using that sesame oil, and even a little bit, even you can wipe it down a little bit before you exercise, but you put it on your body, you change, you know, massage it in for 5 minutes, put on your exercise clothes. If it's too oily, you just wipe it down and you'll still have some of it stay on. But you're actually supporting your body. You're supporting your body with that potential of estrogen, which is an anti-inflammatory, which helps recovery tremendously. But it also settles like the nervous system and gives you a much better workout.
Does that mean that if you put oil on your body while exercising, that you're going to be like burning that oil and not burning your own body fat?
No, not at all. You'll still be burning your body fat, but your joints will be protected. Your body will, like, your nervous system will be more grounded. You'll have better flow, better circulation. It's going to give you more of your exercise, not less.
Awesome. And then I'm sure you've been asked this before, but there's all this idea out there about the problems with seed oils. Is sesame oil, does it fall into any of the potential issues of, quote, seed oils?
If it's refined, anything that is refined is like a fossil fuel in your body. It's going to create inflammation, global warming inside. But if it's unrefined, it's cold pressed, it's expeller pressed, any of these things, you're fine. You have nothing to worry about.
Amazing. And then just some last questions about your book in general. So I have it in front of me right now. It's so beautiful. I'm always really intrigued with like design and stuff for the image on the cover with the colors and everything. Did you have a lot of options for the cover? Did you intuitively know what you wanted it to look like? Or I'm just always fascinated by the design process.
Can I just tell you, Melanie, the book wrote itself. The book You know, I will say that I was imperfect. Like, I heard people's stories of writing books and they were like, it took the life out of them. For me, my daughters are like, Mom, when did you write the book? You were doing everything else, right? Because I was teaching a program, which is a 21-day program. I was doing this. I was living this. I was writing for a few hours every day. And when the cover was proposed to me by my publishers, honestly, I didn't like a single cover. And then I have a niece who is a graphic designer, and she won India's first Cannes. Like, she's very talented, globally recognized. And I didn't really want to bother her because she has such a busy job. I didn't want to bother her with like, hey, can you make my, you know, can you design my cover for me? But well, it just so happened that she ended up telling her mom that I wish Nidhi could design my cover. Like, I wish I could design Nidhi's book cover. And I normally wouldn't meet her mom in years, right? We'd all live in separate parts of the world. But it just, again, so happened that freak accident that I met her mother somewhere. And she was like, hey, you know, by the way, my daughter really wants to design your book cover. And like, I couldn't have done it better myself. Like, she just knew there was alignment. There was so much alignment in this book. I cannot even tell you. Like, that's why I say the book wrote itself. The universe conspired to make it happen in every possible way.
I love the cover. So she nailed it. So also in the book writing process, so the 21-day program, did you develop that specifically for the book, or did you have that already in your work?
So I worked like something like that with my clients, with my existing clients, but I didn't bring it into 21 days. You know, I would do it over a period of time. And I think then I started a coaching program around the same time that I wrote the outline for the book. And so I was doing both. I have a 21-day radical transformation program that I run where women go through, but that's a little bit of more mind and body both. And the book is more body. So the program looks a little bit different because it really has a deep dive into all the habit patterns and mental and emotional patterns that we hold. And so I would say that they supported and they fueled each other at the time I was writing the book. But before that, I worked only one-on-one with clients and I introduced all these principles, but not in the exact same way.
Okay, awesome. Well, so you were saying that the book, you know, essentially kind of wrote itself for the 21 days. Was there, because 21, you know, that's 21 different things. Were there more that you wanted to include? Did it immediately come to you, like the 21 things? Yeah, I'm just wondering if there was some like once it didn't make the cut.
No, you know, not much, right, Melanie? Because I was also teaching a program. So I was getting active feedback into what was helping people, what was not helping people, what was really working out. And I have to say that I would say 90% of it is what, because of the previous practice that I've had. I've been 10 years practicing, you know, with clients one-on-one. And I have seen, you know, what are the smallest shifts which create the biggest impact firsthand I've seen with my clients. So when it came to writing the book, I felt like I already knew, and somehow it was just, you know, 21 just worked out and that was the number. And then I tried it again with coaching groups. And so I had a lot of feedback. So I would say certain things, certain explanations. I have to give a lot of credit to all the women that were in my coaching programs because their feedback, their questions, they really enriched my understanding and what went into the book.
Amazing. And working with those women, because I know at one point in the book you say, you know, if you only were to take away one thing from the book, it's this role of, which we didn't talk about the word. Is it pronounced Agni?
Agni.
Agni. Okay, Agni. And you talk about how it, you know, it rises at sunrise, it's highest midday, and it wanes in the evening. And you know, that relates to your digestive fire, and it's what we talked about earlier. So I'm curious, were there, because you just mentioned how, you know, like one thing can so radically change somebody's life. Are there certain principles, like when a person gets your book and there's the program, should they just go through each day, do it, you know, how they feel and see if it sticks or not? Can you go out of order? Like how should somebody just approach all of this?
I would say that you must, you know, there's a lot of people who want to go directly to part three because they're like, give me the action, right? And I will say that to any of those people, you cannot, there's no sustainability in that because tomorrow you'll you'll take the action I prescribe, and then day after somebody else, you know, somebody else's prescription of action. So I usually am non-prescriptive. So I tell people, stay with part one, stay with part two, like, which is non-action, right? Which really allows you to connect with these rhythms of the universe and stay in awe and wonder of that. Like really stay in wonder of, wow, look at these species. Like I recently had somebody from one of my coaching groups go to South Africa for a safari, and she sent me like so many videos, and she was like, my mind is blown because I'm constantly thinking of all the principles and how these animals live, for example, right? And like my clients and people I work with do this all the time. So I say part one is very important because that allows you to live in awe and wonder. And when you live in awe and wonder and make changes as a result of that awe and wonder, the change is internal. You don't, it's not action, it's effortless. Like you're just like, it's like wearing a sweater on a cold day. You're not like, it doesn't feel like you have to check a box for it because you're so connected with the experience. So I'd say part one. And then part two allows you to map out what you might be doing and then come to part three in terms of picking what you'll do. I would say the first 10 days you want to do, and you want to do the first 10 days in order. You can take 20 days to do the 10 days, which means you do it a little bit slower. And then, or you give justice to all the 21 days. You keep stacking practices one after the other. They're all to be stacked. And they're very easy and simple and doable. And then after 21 days, you can actually decide which ones you want to drop. I give you an option. There's a mastery section, which allows you to like unselect some practices, do some practices, create that little plan, sustainability plan for yourself, that what you're going to do and how many days on the weekdays, on how many times on the weekend, how many times on vacation. But it allows you to plan it and map it out so that you're not stuck or you're not feeling compromised on what you want to do.
Hi, friends. Out of all of the incredible biohacking devices that I use to optimize my health and wellness, there is one type of biohacking device that I have been using the longest. We are talking every single day of my life because it radically changes my life that much. It helps my energy levels, my sleep, my anxiety, so many things. You might know what it is. It is the category of blue light blocking glasses. I just found an upgraded form of this, which does so much more than just block blue light. There's a company called Hyperlite Optics. They've been established in Europe for years and are just now coming to the US. And here's what makes their glasses so special. You might have heard me talk about C60 on the show before. Hyperlite Optics actually uses patented Swiss technology with fullerene C60 as a quantum light transformer. Basically, they transform bad light into healthy, beneficial light. As light passes through the lenses, the fullerene actually twists at a near inconceivable 18 billion times per second, altering photon orientation. So this takes problematic wavelengths of light that we're exposed to in our modern environment and transforms it into healthy light. They are the ultimate ideal form of blue light blocking glasses. And they come in the coolest styles ever. These are truly luxury glasses. They are such high quality. I have never found blue light blocking glasses like this before. They're truly right up there with all those fancy name brands people are tempted to buy. Prepare yourself to get a lot of compliments. Plus, unlike normal blue light blocking glasses, which you might just wear at night, you can wear these all the time. In the morning, the afternoon, the evening, inside, outside. You can turn every moment that you look at the world into a therapeutic experience for your eyes. They're great to use at the computer. They'll reduce your eye strain, headaches, fatigue. You can wear them at night to regulate your circadian rhythm, especially if you're looking at devices, and you will sleep so much better. And did I mention they have so many styles and look so cool? By the way, if you want the model that you've probably seen me wearing a lot on social media, those are the Eclipse Blue model. And like I said, they are new to the US, and I have one of the only discount codes available. You can get 10% off one pair of Hyperlite, 15% off two pairs, and 15% off all future purchases once you buy one pair with the coupon code Melanie10 at hyperliteoptics.com/Melanie. That's right, 10% off one pair, 15% off two or more pairs, and 15% off all future purchases with the coupon code Melanie10, M-E-L-A-N-I-E-10, at hyperliteoptics.com/Melanie. Awesome. The hardest thing maybe for my audience, specifically when they read the book, which I agree, I'm such a fan of always reading the entire book because it's so important to get, you know, the foundation of everything and the information and the knowledge and the science so you can really understand the why behind the protocol. You make a suggestion
during this program to not consume other like health related information and just, you know, trust the process and do the program. And I mean, the nature of this show is people listening to podcasts to constantly try to find new information. So what's the reasoning behind that? And what do you say to people who want to constantly be, you know, I mean, like learning new things? Where's the balance between committing to a program, trying it versus, you know, still seeking knowledge elsewhere?
And I'd say that what most people are seeking, Malini, is information and not knowledge. The word knowledge also has a knowing in it, you know, like wisdom. There's a very strong internal part that's also very active. I think what we do mostly today is like, give me more information. And honestly, the more information we have, the less insight we have. We start disconnecting from what we already know, right? Like, for example, a baby, right, Malini, we're born and we just find the mother's breast. The baby knows how to suckle. The baby knows that to eat, it needs to eat from the mother's breast. I mean, no nutrition needed, no expert needed, right? And yet we begin to forget as we start over-intellectualizing things and getting more and more information. So I'm not saying that information from the outside world is not good. But I think if you look at how everything was studied and written in the past, especially the Vedic wisdom, which is where Ayurveda and yoga come from, it was first experienced and then validated through existing information. So you have the experience and then you would go to a teacher or a master and say, I had this experience. This is what I'm thinking. And then you would refer to maybe a text. And then you would say, oh, this makes sense or not. We're doing the reverse today. We're getting information first and then we're bringing it into experience. The truth is we all know, like animals know, if we're the most intelligent species, how did we forget? I mean, like if animals can pick specific plants and herbs when they're sick and they understand what sulfur-rich soil is without having to take it into a laboratory. And I'm not discounting science or the role of research, but I'm saying there's a lot that we already know. And that's why the book is called Your Body Already Knows. We want to start trusting that so that when we're looking at information from the outside world, we already know which one doesn't work for us, right? For example, Melanie, I'm going to give one last example. If you and I were sitting in a really cold room and you're feeling really, really cold, and if I gave you the advice that, hey, you know, why don't you take off this one little sweater you have? It's going to make you feel warmer. You're not going to trust that advice because you already know. You've experienced it. You're like, taking the sweater out is going to make me feel even more cold. Like, because you know, right? Like, that's the experience you had. And it's possible to have that same experience with what we consume internally and to understand exactly, not vaguely, exactly what's happening in our body. So we just need to come back to that wisdom. And the book kind of provides a framework to start doing that.
I love that. Perfect. And that's like a perfect way to bring everything full circle. Well, thank you so much, Nadee. This has been, like I said, amazing. I so enjoyed reading the book. I learned so much. It's really opened my eyes and given me a paradigm shift. So how can people best get the book, follow your work? Can they, because you mentioned, you know, your program, which has even more of the mental, emotional aspect to things. Can people sign up for that? Where should people go?
Yeah, thank you for asking. So if you want to just a snippet of mine every day, I am on Instagram under my_Ayurvedic_life, or you can just look for my name, Nidhi Pandya, and you'll be able to find it. And if, Melanie, you have show notes, I'd love for you to link it. You can go to my website, nidhipandya.com. That's my first name, last name, .com. And right now, I'm not running the 21-day Radical Transformation Program anymore in groups because I've gone back to one-on-one work. And the book has kept me really, really busy. But in 2026, I will be restarting those group coaching and offerings. I am, however, teaching a nutrition, a very deep, very comprehensive Ayurvedic nutrition program that starts end of October. And it is for people who want to understand how to live in this manner for themselves. And you can eat any cuisine. So it's not a restrictive program. Or you can do the program to become a certified Ayurvedic nutritionist. So these are a few things that are on my plate right now. But you can find me and you can find all of this information on my website as well as my Instagram.
Amazing. That's okay. This is so great because I think this will be airing in the fall. So I think a lot of my audience will be really interested in that nutrition program for sure and all the other stuff. So we will put links to all of that in the show notes. Thank you so, so much. Are you writing another book?
I want to, just when I settle down a little bit with this one. And book contracts are designed in a funny way that for 2 years I can't have anything else out, but I am waiting for that end of 2 years for it to happen.
Amazing. Awesome. Awesome. And then the last question that I ask every single guest on this show, and actually, because I'm pulling up your list of the days. So it relates to the last day of your 21 days. So that works out well. It's the role of gratitude, which I just think is so, so important in life. So what is something that you're grateful for?
Oh, that's a lot of things. I think what I'm most grateful for, honestly, is the chance, like the way I found my ikigai in this life, and to have a life which has purpose beyond just the mundanities of what everyday life brings, to be so deeply connected to my purpose. I'm so grateful for everything that has happened, how I was born into the family, for all the things I chanced upon, for being able to see my children grow with this philosophy, and just constantly be in it all the time. Love it.
I love that so much. I feel the same way, just the gratitude for having life's purpose, because I see all this content out there about people who are struggling to find a purpose and how do you find your passion and your purpose. And I've never had that experience. I'm like, I've always been like very purpose driven. And it's like you said, I'm so grateful because I know not everybody has that experience. Well, thank you so much, Nadee. This was amazing. I am so grateful and appreciative for all you do. And yes, if you have another book in the future, I would love to have you back on.
Thank you so much for having me, Melanie. I've really enjoyed all the deep and such relevant questions that you've asked. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of your day.
You too. Take care. Bye.
Bye. Thank you so much for listening to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. For more information and resources, you can check out my book, What, When, Wine, as well as my supplement line, Avalon X. Please visit melanieavalon.com to learn more about today's guest, and always feel free to contact me at contact@melanieavalon.com. And always remember, you got this.